Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with drummer Bob Fullrod. Bob's story is interesting because he started playing with the drum his grandpa gave him at 5 years old, and he commandeered a pot to act as the sock symbol. He played with his grandfather's friends who came over to jam and was playing essentially professionally by the time he was 8. At 12, he was playing the Hollywood Bowl, and at 14, accompanying a 14-year-old Johnny Mathis. Listen to this amazing story. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are, not the person you think you need to be, not the person other people are, not the person someone told you you had to be, and in so many cases, not even the person you think you are, but the person you really are. Unfortunately, in too many childhoods, children get the idea that something about them is not okay. And they start pretending right out that that thing, whatever it is, a quality, an idea, a way of being, an interest, is not true. And children can get so good at that they forget that what was true of them was ever true, and come into adulthood pretending, essentially, to be someone they're not. The Lynn Show is about saying that even if this happened to you, even if your childhood demanded that you hide or pretend something essential about yourself, even if you came into adulthood without access to some important aspect of your own being, it may not be too late to recover what you may have lost. Because those things which we hide in childhood, for which we are in denial in adulthood, are not gone. They're waiting. And they can be resurrected. They can be recaptured. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And today's interview with Bob Fullrod demonstrates so clearly what I am trying to say. This is a man who recognized at 5 that he had a natural ability to play drums. The minute his grandfather gave him this drum, he knew what to do with it. And even though playing the drums is not an easy career, and Bob has other interests and other skills, being a musician is essentially what defines him, and he never let go of it. Here now is drummer Bob Fullrod. Okay, so I'm here with drummer Bob Fullrod, and I'm explaining to Bob that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I only ask one question.
Sure.
And it is, can you remember the very first time in your life that playing the drums or music captured you, seemed attractive to you, became interesting?
I started at 5.
5. What happened?
My grandfather, who I lived with, played the piano and he sang. And he had friends. They came over to the house all the time and made music.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a drum that I think he bought me at that time. And I remember getting a pot and putting it on a music stand as if it was a sock symbol.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a sock symbol. I don't know where I had seen that or heard it or whatever.
Okay, so you knew about that.
I did.
Right, but you don't remember how you found that, but you knew about it. So you created your own little drum set?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And you were 5?
I was 5.
And were you playing with these guys?
They would come in and they would, like, in their own way, they would jam. I don't remember the songs. They're a mixture of everything. But I kept time with the snare drum and playing on the pot. So I had some concept.
You're saying that you had the sense of the rhythm and how to keep time.
I did.
Even then.
I did.
That it was a naturally occurring thing for you.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And I'm assuming that you liked it.
No, I loved it.
Yeah, you loved it, of course. So do you remember, was it the percussive part of it, or was it being part of the music? Or
I think it was both.
Yeah?
And being a part of the grown-ups were giving me some attention,
mm-hmm.
which was helpful and encouraging. But it was also the feeling of the moment that was taking place with them. They were happy. The feeling was really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they loved the music.
They did.
Yeah. And so you were part of this thing that felt really good, right?
Yeah.
And it must have been startling to them, a 5-year-old playing drums. I mean,
it was more startling seeing me in the Benefits Boy marching band.
Well, tell me how that happened.
I went to get my snare drum. I found out that the guy that ran the store had a band, and it was to promote his store naturally, but it was also, it was a big concert marching band.
Mm-hmm.
Had a uniform and everything.
Were they all your age?
A range of age.
Mm-hmm.
Range of age. I was the youngest probably in the band.
And were you marching?
Yes.
With your drum?
With my drum. I got pictures of it.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So you started playing very young.
Very young.
So did you take lessons?
I don't remember taking lessons there. I remember when I first started taking lessons, it was when I moved to Oakland. I must have been 8 years old, perhaps. My mother had me take a lesson. She was the entertainer and the musician in the house. She sang.
Mm-hmm.
And so she thought that I had talent and got me to start taking lessons.
So was there a band in school? Did you play with friends?
In grammar school, I played in a grammar school band class.
And you were the drummer?
Yes.
I see. I mean, so you're playing all your life, essentially.
Yes. Well, I was taking lessons when I was 10. And that's when things started moving a little bit, because they used to take me to this theater that brought in jazz people. Lionel Hampton was the first group that I ever saw. And then when I got to be 11 years old, I started taking piano. I had 5 years of classical piano. And this teacher had a boyfriend who was an agent. And I was in Santa Barbara during the summer, and I got a phone call, and they flew me up to Oakland to audition for the Horace Heights show.
You were 11?
Yes.
Good grief.
11 turning 12. And Horace Heights was an amateur show, and we had to fly down to L.A., compete, and then whatever, if I won, then I'd come back the next week. But as it turned out, I won 4 times. I had an act that we built between the piano and the drums.
Just you?
Yes.
You would run back and forth between the piano and the drums?
I play Bumble Boogie and different things like that. It was always Boogie Woogie with a little bit of showmanship on the piano, and then running over to the drums and playing a solo on the drums.
You were a one-man band.
Well, in that case, I was.
Yes, you were. And you were so young. Are you thinking about this as a life work?
I was into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I was definitely into it. I won like 4 times and then went back for a quarter of 5 in the Hollywood Bowl. And it was the first time I performed in a really big place. It was 20,000 people.
You know, you're saying it's the first time. We're 12, right?
Yeah.
And you were performing in the Hollywood Bowl. I mean, come on.
I know.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, when I think about it, I rarely think about it, but when you asked me to interview, and I started thinking, what have I done? And it started coming up all these things. So I had an act. I had an agent. I was doing roadshow with the great Gildersleeve and Jimmy Durante and Dennis Day. I was traveling back and forth to different cities.
In your teen years?
Yeah. Oh
my God. And you were making money, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah. I made more money than my father.
I'm sure.
It was exciting.
What an amazing experience. You didn't realize how extraordinary it was, what was happening to you.
I knew something was happening, but I didn't think about it that way. I was just having fun.
Yes, well, there couldn't have been that many 12-year-olds on the tour.
I think I was the only kid.
You must have been amazing.
I had an act. Kid, being a kid and all that.
You were a novelty.
You have a very big benefit.
Okay, so it's your teen years. You're making a fortune. You're flying all over the place. You're playing with all these famous people. What happens?
In the studio that I was involved with Connie Coford, who was my piano teacher, came Johnny Mathis.
Mm.
And when Johnny Mathis got there, since I was playing piano, we would go to do some local shows. And so I would play piano for Johnny.
Venues. He didn't bring his own piano player?
No, he was the same age as I was. He'd been about 14.
14? Johnny Mathis was 14?
Yeah.
And he was on the road?
Oh, Johnny Mathis at that age was phenomenal. Everybody knew he was going to be a star. Everybody.
He
was phenomenal. So I was relegated to playing piano with him.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. But okay, that's astonishing. So what else happened?
Black Hawk Club, San Francisco. It's a famous jazz place. And the owner saw Johnny and wangled a contract with him. When that happened, then he moved from the studio where I was at that point. And things just kind of drifted apart.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on his way and really did, obviously.
He was Johnny Mathis.
Johnny Mathis.
Right. Right.
But it also got me over to the Blackhawk Club where I met Virgil Gonzalez. I may have been 17 because I quit high school because I had met John Handy. And in school at that time, there was nothing happening musically. And I really wanted to spend all my energy and time playing music. So I was able to talk to my parents about it, and they let me do it. So Virgil got me into the band and then became part-time house band to the Blackhawk. This was at a time when Max Roach, Miles Davis, Coltrane, all these people were coming to the Blackhawk.
Oh, my.
So, I was, in heaven.
I'm sure.
I couldn't believe what was going on. And I was in John Handy's band soon after. I knew I was going to go to New York eventually. And when John told me that he might be able to do something with Mingus, then I jumped at it and flew out to New York. Then I think I was 24. So anyhow, I got to New York and I was rehearsing with Charlie Mingus when Danny Richmond came back. So that was the end of my dream for getting into a band of that level. And from that point on, it was like building my own career individually.
Okay, so now you're in New York and Charlie Mingus didn't happen. And so what did happen?
San Francisco, I was doing really well. I was hired a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But when I moved to New York, it was a much bigger pond with a lot of big fish in the pond. I had to start again. But the one thing that I had realized at that point is I was going to need to read really well if I was going to be successful. So I went to Sam Ulano, who was a drum teacher there,
mm-hmm.
and studied with him. I lived in the Village. But we were working in Bleecker Street. That's when Bobby Dylan was down the street at Cafe Wa. And I was working with Archie Shepp and a couple other people down in the Village, mm-hmm. and in the coffee shops. There was a lot of work going on that time for $5 a night, $7 a night. It was
right.
But the quality of work was really fantastic.
The work was great, but the money was terrible.
I'll forget it. I was almost paying to go there myself. You know?
Yeah.
So I was doing a lot of work and enjoying it. And things began to change, though, because disco came out.
Mm-hmm.
And when disco came out, a lot of places started using disc jockeys.
Mm-hmm.
And once they got the disc jockeys, a lot of musicians were out at
that
point.
Right.
So you really had to scuffle around to make money and make a living. And I worked a year at the Playboy and, you know, got exposed to a lot of good people. Well, I still stayed in the Village and managed to find work, you know, for small sums of money. I worked with Paul Blay and others who were in a whole different idiom of music, which was really good because it exposed me to getting away from standard forms of jazz and moving into more of a freestyle thing, which was really good and interesting. Virgil was in New York, and he introduced me to Carmen McRae.
Mm.
And so I went on the road with Carmen McRae. But when I came back off the road with Carmen, I was white. And it really taught me what it was like being on the road and getting exposed to a lot of things that were just uncomfortable. Nothing that I wanted to spend my life doing, but I still wanted to be a musician. And I, you know, I was really trying to figure out what to do at that point. Lenox Jazz School in Lenox, Massachusetts. The people that were there were the Modern Jazz Quartet, Bill Evans, Kenny Durham, Max Roach, Sonny Rollins was there.
Oh my.
All these people. I studied with Max during that time, excited about it, but he couldn't make any money, couldn't get any work. It was really difficult. And I really hated club date work. I remember going to a gig in Brooklyn. Nobody had a car.
Right.
So I have one trap case that weighs 45 pounds in my right hand and a bass drum in the left hand. I'm going to the subway. I get to Brooklyn, and it's a four-story, and the escalator's not working. And I had to carry the thing up and down, do the job, carry it up and down, get home. And it started asking the question whether I want to be doing that at 50 years old or 40 years old. Max had gone to a Manhattan School of Music and told me about it, as did John Lewis. I think he was there for a while. So I went up there, and the guy who interviews you says, well, all you play is jazz. It was classic. They didn't have jazz classes and courses at that point. So I really got yanked about this guy making that kind of an observation. And I found the percussion teacher. He was there that day. And he auditioned me on the spot, and I got a scholarship.
Oh, wow.
So I was able to walk by this guy that I first saw with a smile on my face. And I got two master's degrees, one in performance and one in education. And the only reason I took the education one is I figured, well, you know, if I need to make some money. I wasn't at the level where I was going to be making a living playing music that I really wanted to play.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took a psychology course, which probably was the best thing I ever did. The guy that taught psychology course was a psychodramatist. He turned out to be a very good therapist for me. He introduced me to psychodrama. It really grabbed me because it was like jazz. It was like music. It had spontaneity and creativity, and it really excited me. I grew up being called stupid, so I had no idea I could ever go to college, not to mention I was the first one in my family to go to college. So I got into therapy, and it was the therapy that really turned my head around about what I could do and what I wanted to do, and it didn't mean that I had to stop playing. So I got my own practice in New Jersey as a clinical social worker. I went to Manhattan School of Music first and finished the master's courses there. I went to Hunter College of Social Work for 2 years and got my master's there.
That's amazing.
When I look back on it, it seemed to be, I wasn't thinking about it then.
No, you were just putting one foot in front of the other.
One foot in front of the other.
But it is amazing. I mean, you had a lot of balls in the air at the same time.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So the first job I had was working at Lower East Side Service Center in New York, which was for addiction. But they were licensed also for psychiatric cases and things like that. Yeah, I worked there for 4 years and got a lot of experience, which was helpful, and was able to use psychodrama in the work that I was doing and everything. And then I started training staff and doing group therapy.
Okay, so now you're training.
Well, I was also in the program at the Institute. It was a 5 years training to become a psychodramatist.
Oh, wow.
And individual therapist.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing that at the same time. And then what happened 4 years into the job with the Lower East Side Service Center, I got a job in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, because this job is in Jersey, I figured I may as well move over to Jersey for the time being, see what happens. So when I moved over there, I end up meeting Harriet. I knew that she was the one,
mm-hmm.
and moved in together in Montclair. She was, and it was easy to get in New York that way because I was still, I had my practice in New York and I was still working gigs.
Okay, hold on. So you did open a private practice.
I did.
Right.
After Lower East Side Service.
After the, right.
There was a place in Jersey that I worked.
So you were working at an agency in New Jersey. You still had a private practice in New York?
No, what happened was I decided it was 81 that I wanted to open up a practice when I was working in New Jersey because I didn't want to work in a community center the rest of my life either. And so as soon as I made the same amount of money that I was making in the center with the private, we opened a place. And she's a therapist also. She's an art therapist, an artist. So we worked together. She had her office, I had my office.
And lovely. We
settled in Montclair.
Terrific. Okay, so how long did you do that? And I'm assuming you're playing at the same time.
Yes.
Whenever you can.
Whenever I can.
Right.
And I mean, how long did we do the practice?
Yeah.
From 81 to 2.5 years ago.
Wow. Wow. And yeah. Then did you move here? Is that?
And then we moved down here.
Wow, so now you're trying to figure out what to do with the rest of your life.
Oh, this is true.
So now you're playing a lot, though.
Around here, I'm in Don Stewart's band. It's a big band.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe Bruno, you know Joe Bruno Jr.? And
mm-hmm.
He's in the band now, the bass player. And a person named Peter Breckenridge, he's a great player,
mm-hmm.
and great arranger, and he brings in arrangements. So this band is like really, it's just getting exciting, you mm-hmm. know. It's, and the thing is, I worked a lot of gigs going out of town with big bands, but it wasn't the same thing. It wasn't, they didn't have rehearsals. And I don't even know how I got in the band because I didn't play in big bands. And I guess it felt like they were doing me a favor almost. But I seemed to do it okay enough that I kept doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got down here and had this opportunity, which was by accident, I read in Jazz Club of Sarasota, they had the announcement that they rehearsed this band on Wednesdays. Come and sit down and listen to the band if you like. So I wanted to go hear the band, and I called him up. He says, what do you do? He says, I play drums. He says, can you bring your drums down? Which was really good because, you know, the way it happened, he needed a drummer.
Yes.
The timing was great.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got down there, I began to learn what I don't know and
about
big band drumming.
Ah.
Because it's a whole different thing.
Really?
I'm used to small groups.
Mm-hmm.
So, slowly but surely, it's starting to come together in a way that I like.
Okay, so that's what you're doing here, is you're playing as often as you can and trying
as
to decide
often.
Whether it's enough.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And this band, the first band with Harry, that's a sextet.
Mm-hmm.
And this band's a full, you know, big band. In fact, we're having a concert on the 29th down in the gazebo in 41.
What gazebo in 41?
Felipe Park.
Oh, yeah. When is it?
It's on the 29th of the month.
Of March?
March.
Okay, I have one more question.
Okay.
And it is, talking just about your life as a musician,
mm-hmm.
you have spent essentially your whole life as a musician.
Right.
You were not only a musician, but you were a musician your entire life.
I've always been. That's been the backdrop.
Yes, from... Yeah. You know, five, right?
Right.
Right. So what would you say about what that's like to have given your life, so much of your life, to this work?
What would I say about it?
Yeah.
I'd probably be dead if I didn't have it.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you say why?
Well, I mean, I don't mean to make it not harsh a level. It's just, I mean, I would have probably found something else, I suppose. But music's been so exciting and energizing in my life. And it's who I am. And people recognize it and they get something from it. I'm able to contribute, you know, in the life, whatever you call it, to people, then that feels great. You know, it really feels good that when you're playing, you know, with a group, and the group's cooking, and people are smiling, and they're enjoying themselves. It's, you know, it's very important. I couldn't do without it.
That is a perfect place to stop. Thank you so much, Bob.
Thank you for having me.
I couldn't do without it. It's who I am. When someone talks about what they do for a living in this way, you know they are describing who they really are. And it is my hope that when you listen to Bob, you're asking yourself, is this how I feel about my life? Do I feel that I couldn't do without the way I spend my days, the way I spent my life? Well, if that's not true for you, if you had to leave behind some aspect of yourself, if you suspect that there is something about you that you can't quite get access to, and you want to talk to me about it, please go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, THELYNNE. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com. Click on the email tab. Ask me any questions you might have. I'll be glad to answer you. And as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show, something that inspired you, something that amused you, something that you learned that you didn't know, but something that'll bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. On singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang, so you won't hear.